weekend.
That was Gene Pritzker's brand new introduction to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, which this is day two of our 20th anniversary celebration. We'll be here for the next 2 hours and 357 seconds.
Yes.
And we're going to talk to some people today across the pond and have a good time doing that. And
first up is...
What? What's first up?
Jim, no. Are you talking to us? No,
he's not talking to us. We're going to go right across. We're going to try to reach.
Oh, yes. We're first going to say, this is WGDR Plainfield.
And WGDH Hardwick Community Radio.
Community Radio.
From Goddard College.
From Community Radio.
See if we can reach our first guest from Amsterdam, Dante Bone. He wants to talk about stuff. He's given me a list of things he'd like to talk about. And Wandelweiser, music for musicians, different ways to play together. And about people like Christian Wolff and Samuel Friesen, Antoine Becher, Manfred Werder, John Cage, silence, melody, phrasing, new ways of... Let's see if we can reach him today.
Just in case, does he have a CD on which to line up to?
Oh, yes, we do have something from him, if need be.
We heard that sound so often yesterday.
Yes, we did.
Hi, Dennis.
Hey, it's Dante. Hey. Nice to hear from you.
I'm just listening to your voice. Yeah, no. That's, yeah. Hi, how are you doing?
We're doing very, very well. We haven't seen you in quite a while. And catch us up a little bit before we dive into some of the things you wanted to talk about.
Yes. Because I'm not on the air right now, right?
Yes, you are.
Yes. Oh, I am? Oh,
yes.
Okay. Because I was listening just now. I was listening to your... you saying this was the introduction tune for Calvos and Damien, blah, blah, blah. So somehow it's not synchronized or something.
We're on a 24-minute delay.
Anyway. we're actually on a very slight delay because of the rules of the Federal Communications Commission. If bad words come out, they don't like them on radio here.
We could try it. So
No, we won't try it.
We won't.
No.
Never mind.
Never mind.
Okay, great. Well, and I have to tell you that the connection is not ideal, so there may be some hesitation sometimes on part.
Well, you know, we can try calling your telephone. How would that work?
That would be actually...
Okay, let's do that. And before we before we reach you, we're going to play the piece that you've given us, 12X or 12 times. How do you pronounce that?
12 times.
Okay.
12
times by Dante Bone.
And that would be...
That'd be right there. And we'll call you back on your telephone. Yeah, so you're getting that lined up, and we'll call Dante in mere moments.
Thank you.
12 Times by Dante Bone, who is with us from Amsterdam. And welcome again, now that we've got a good connection.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah, and first of all, I want to say congratulations on your anniversary. Happy anniversary with the Galveston Day Union.
Ah, thanks much.
And, and I'm happy to be on your show.
So, you sent me this wonderful list of things you'd like to talk about. Let's start out with Wandelweiser, because that's not very well known over here in the States. Give us a little précis about that and how it fits in together with some of the musicians you were talking about.
Yes. Well, it's first of all, I think Wandelweiser historically it means that it's a group of composers, performers who also somehow start aesthetically with the 4:33 piece of John Cage. And so he's also very well connected to the experimental composers, especially the American experimental composers like Alvin Lucier, Tenney, etc. And also the New School. And it has to do about the notion that time is music, and music is time, and that you can compose structurally with time. But I think by now it has become like more an environment in which composers can be don't have to explain their music anymore. So everywhere I come and people play my music or Wandelweiser music by Anton van Beuger or Michael Pizarro or other Wandelweiser composed people tend to know what the idea is and what the music is about. And there's no need for conductors or anything like that. So it has become more or less like a tradition in the last 10 years or so, where people have found this environment to play music, which is beautiful. Like where you can say that the aesthetics of the music that we are playing is to be beautiful and to be about sound. To me, that's the most important aspect of it right now. So it's a very social thing. For me as a composer, it means that people know what I'm doing when I give them my piece. It falls into this warm, it is welcomed as a piece of music instead of like what would be like a very... if you exaggerate a little bit, like the whole modernist approach to music is that you have an ensemble with a conductor, you give them the score and they play the notes and that's it, and there's no real connection between the musicians and the music you've written, if you're not lucky, that is, of course.
Yes, of course,
lucky with the musicians, but somehow that has become sort of a modernist music festival ensemble cliche, which is, I think, too often very true. And where, because people are always talking about the audience, that the audience doesn't feel any connection to new music anymore. But I think it all starts with the musicians. I think musicians should know, like with the older tradition of playing music at home, that you play music at home just to enjoy yourself with other people, with friends. And this whole aspect of the social aspect of making music has become important again within the Wandelweiser circle. So to me, that's the most important aspect of it.
Now, Wandelweiser goes back about, 22, 23 years now? And what drove the reason for its existence? For example, in the sense of modernism, we understand that there's a need for someone to bring it together, that musicians aren't necessarily connected. But on the other hand, the minimalist school doesn't necessarily need a conductor either, and they don't seem to be connected to me to what Wandelweiser is doing, particularly perhaps what Christian Wolff might be doing, or especially John Cage. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, there is some overlap because James Tenney, who's, of course, he's not a Wandelweiser composer, but very close to some of the aesthetics of Wandelweiser. He played in the Philip Glass Ensemble for a long time.
Right, yes.
And also both Steve Reich and also Terry Riley and Philip Glass and all the other minimalist composers, many of them came from this experimentalist approach from the early 60s, and also actually came from Cage. So, but it's a whole different way of dealing with time, but it's still a way of dealing with time, which is not connected to any developmental ways of thinking, which is, I think that's a very important thing. So it's more like a sort of an abstract music. And I think the interesting thing is that the minimalists almost immediately went back into tonality with their music. And this has happened in Wanderweiser too, because there's somehow there's the notion of if you have time as your main parameter, you can do whatever you want to fill in the time you've created for your music, and then things can happen without this whole rhetorical aspect to it of tonality meaning something or being about tension or all that the kind of thing,
right?
But just it being something which happens in time and about the sound of it, and even now. At this moment, there's Jörg Frey, the Swiss, one of the Swiss composers in Wanderweiser. His last string quartet even contains a lot of dominant seventh chords, which was like 20 years ago, that was impossible to even think about if you would use that like very structurally.
Yes, structurally.
But he does, but not in a tonal sense that they have to, resolve or anything afterwards. But he uses them really like dominant seven chords. You can't say, oh, that's by coincidence or something. But he can, because it's about filling in the silence, and you fill in the silence with dominant seven chords. I think that's the overlap with the minimalism, with the minimalist composers.
You mentioned a strong relationship between composer and performer being actually, in many cases, one and the same. If that's the case, how does the audience become part of this? Are they a specialized audience or not?
I think there are always a specialized audience, because in my experience, the audience is always very small, which again reminds me of the 19th century or even like more the 18th century tradition of playing music at home for just a few people with an intimate environment. So I don't know. I always have the feeling those are the specialists, because they are always there in the audience, and there's never been, in my experience, for 600 people in a big... Things like that have happened, I think, in England at the BBC or something, but I wasn't there, and I have no idea what happened there. But up till now, it has always been a very specialized environment in a way. So, which is nice, because people know what you're doing, even when they're in the audience, and they don't have to be musicians, but they know what it's all about, because it's a sort of aesthetics of music, which is somehow and. Of course, people, when they know the word Wanderweiser or the group, they know that it can be about silence and about long silences and about long pieces and very soft playing and things like that. So that's already a starting point. So if you know this, you're in the audience, you don't expect anything to happen in terms of loudness or fast music or things like that. So
one last
so that means that yeah.
One last question then. You mentioned you referred to Christian Wolff when you speak of this, yet many of Christian's pieces do require a conductor, and the musicians, although they have improvisational instructions, also have quite specific things that the composer needs them to do and that need to be conducted. Is there some...
Right.
Yeah, is there something else going on here that is not clear?
Well, the way in which Christian Wolff has been very important for many Wanderweiser composers is because he played with them once in a while as well, with Antoine Berger and with Jörg Frey. He's done concerts. Is that his whole approach to music is something you do together. So all of his pieces that are concerned with the way... About how you play together, so making a set of rules, so like the for one, two, or three people, which is a very complicated complex score, where you have to be aware of the other two players all the time, and you have to respond to each other all the time. And in my music, this is very important, but I know of many other composers in Wanderweiser who are also dealing with this all the time. Like so, the whole action of playing and being together with someone. Anton Berger played a lot of made a lot of duos, for example, where it's really about the relation between two players, like the relation between two people and the way they respond to each other. And this is for a great deal thanks to Christian Wolff's music.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing about his using a conductor is that he tries to integrate the conductor in this kind of thinking, which I think is very interesting, because the conductor is a musician as well as everybody else, so he needs to have something to do. Yes. Give him something to do as well, but something which is not in the old sense, like being the leader of everybody, but giving people something to do, but also having being in charge as a musician and not as a leader or like a boss or something. Because for instance, with the John Cage's orchestral pieces, the late pieces, they're beautiful pieces, but they're all for instance, for 101 soloists in the orchestra. But we all know that an orchestra isn't 101 soloists.
Right.
So that's a very utopian, but very, very beautiful idea about how orchestras could become like chamber music. But then somehow you could get problems with balance or things like, or just purely the way people play differently or something. And then you would think, yeah, you would need a conductor to get it even more beautiful or something. And I think Christian Wolff is trying to combine those things of having a conductor for what he or she can do very well and combining with the players. So
I think you've given us an excellent view into the world of Vondelweiser and some of the composers. Dan de Boon from Amsterdam, thank you so much for joining us on Calvos and Damian. This is a great pleasure.
Well, thank you. Same here.
Okay.
And enjoy the rest of your festival.
Thanks. See you in person sometime next year.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, we will. Okay, till then.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. Till then, bye-bye.
Dan de Boon. He's a very interesting guy, as you can tell from his conversation. And he's very committed to the music that he does. Mm-hmm. Very interesting to watch him play. I've seen him play. And there's an intensity in his playing, just as there is an intensity in his dialogue.
The piece that we heard,
yes.
Do you know if he was playing in that?
You know, actually, I don't, but I'm going to guess that he may have been, simply because of his interest in composer plus performer as one. So
yes.
I should have asked him that question. Well, next time we'll ask him.
Is there a Yannis? Is there a Yannis?
We're going to bring him up. Yannis Kyriakides. We met many years ago, actually, in Amsterdam, when we lived over there. And so let's see if we can get him to join us. Yannis Kyriakides, also from Amsterdam. Let's see if we can get him in here.
Hello?
Yannis, yes. Hello. This is...
Hey.
Yeah,
hi.
Great.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Excellent.
You're talking loud and clear as well.
All right.
Yeah.
I haven't seen you in person for many years, and I would like to hear what has happened in your compositional life. The pieces that I heard last were incredibly spare and mm-hmm. very sort of intense and, in some cases, quite long. Tell us about some of the work that you've been doing.
Well, when did I last see you, actually? That's a good question. Basically, the last 10 years, I would say, I've been sort of exploring a lot of multimedia pieces, because I've always been interested in the sort of marriage between electronics and live musicians.
Yes,
in my pieces, and in the last 10 years, I've been exploring more other media with that. So there's a lot of pieces that come out of that with which is visual pieces also, so especially with projected text, animated text. I guess because of that, I've also been interested in this whole idea of musical meaning and stuff around how music communicates, let's put it that way. So, and I guess it's taken from, as you say, me from pieces which are quite sparse, sparse in order for let's say other media to have some kind of expressive element in. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I thought it went a bit quiet. So, and then, or let's say more dense, richer pieces, but still, still with the idea of some kind of space in there that, in a way, you can explore. You don't have to be dictated to, let's say, musically, but you can explore and change perspective. That's probably one of the key things that I'm interested in, is giving a view to the listener to like change their perspective and explore different layers of the music.
Do you help the listener explore these layers by the use of multimedia tools, or are they just part of your compositional process?
I would like to think that I help, because in a way, it has to do with challenging how you might listen to something because of what your information you're getting on a visual level also, and also that goes also for the electronics as well. So the electronics might be creating some kind of pushing you into listen to it in a different way. So it's helping and challenging at the same time. I wouldn't say it's so much. I'm not that interested in the compositional process itself. So I'm more focused on the actual experience, the listening experience.
Uh-huh. The reason I asked the question is that I had an opportunity to at least look into the online work that Michel van der Aa was doing with his opera, where the frame is broken completely by the multimedia, where time and listener experience are broken by the visuals and the timeline of the story.
Which opera was that?
The one I don't remember the name of it, where the cellist.
I know the one. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The cellist sort of comes out of the frame, and we see the cellist in present and future, as young and old, in both video and in real life. So, are you using elements where you break that kind of a frame, or are the elements of your work integrated as part of a compositional, a single compositional process, rather than one in which you sort of step out and grab the audience in that kind of a way?
I like these moments. I'm not sure I do it so much nowadays. I did explore that in the beginning. It's this these kind of what you might have been describing there, is this kind of juncture moments where you're forced to radically change the viewpoint, or change how you the space that you're in case of Michel, I guess, because he's very interested in that this space. And so for me, in those pieces, I think I was doing a lot with how the hierarchy between elements changes radically. So it's like you have to understand the visuals through the music, then you have to understand the music through the visuals. Uh-huh. These kind of plays. So go on.
You've provided us with a piece, Francesco, rough mix, and perhaps that gives us some sort of idea of what you're working on.
Yeah, so this piece, the file is called Francesco Rough Mix, because it's this friend Francesco Dillon, who is just in is a fantastic Italian cellist who was in Amsterdam a few months ago, and he recorded the piece for me. The piece is called Words and Song. God, I've forgotten what my piece is called. Words and Song Without Words, and it's a And the reason I sent it is because it's a bit, it's kind of typical of this area of research that I'm in at the moment, which is this idea of is music a language kind of ideas, and what's the sort of expressive potential in relation to language of music. And in this piece, I use music as a, almost as a surrogate to language.
Do you see that it functions? Does it have a kind of not only a grammar and syntax, but a way in which musical elements can be affixed to something the way words can be affixed to something external?
Exactly. I mean, it's such a large topic, and I don't think I have any particularly radical position on it, but I do think because of the various overlaps between language and music, sometimes we do feel as though that a music might be working, you know, syntactically or grammatically, or that there's something, there's relations between notes and between phrases that acts in a similar way as language, and in this piece, I try and really force them to behave together. And how I do this is usually the piece is performed with also video, where you see each word which is actually encoded using some kind of system into music. Each phrase is played, projected with the word that it's encoding, and the actual piece is based on this one text which I'd found of from a letter of Felix Mendelssohn.
Okay.
And maybe it's worth just saying what he says in the text, because
sure.
It's quite beautiful. He says people often, and he's talking about it's a letter he wrote to an admirer, I think, where he explains the philosophy behind his song Without Words. And he says, people often complain that music is too ambiguous, that what they should think when they hear is so unclear, whereas everyone understands words. That's the kind of typical way we view music in relation to words. But Mendelssohn says, with me, it's exactly the opposite, and not only with regard to entire speech, but also with words. These two seem to me so ambiguous, so vague in comparison to genuine music. So he's saying that with him, it's basically the opposite, that he experiences music as very precise in what it's saying, and words are actually ambiguous. They can mean many things. So it's basically, I take a paragraph of this letter, and we basically hear and read the letter during the piece as a kind of reflection on what are words, in a way, and what is music.
Yeah. Okay, let's hear this. Once again, the title?
The title is Words and Song Without Words.
Okay, and it's an absolute pleasure. I can't wait to see you in person again. I hope to...
When are you coming to Amsterdam?
I expect I'll be there sometime in the spring. That's the goal.
Fantastic.
And we'll make contact then. In the meantime, we'll hear this piece, and we thank you incredibly much for joining us today.
Yeah, Dennis, it was really great talking to you. And congratulations again for the Calvus and Damien.
Thanks.
Happy birthday.
Thanks so much.
Bye, Dennis.
Bye.
Thank you.
Words and song without songs without words by
or words and songs.
Yannis Kyriakides, fantastic composer. We interviewed him, and I actually first met him when I guess in 1992, a long time ago, when I was living over there. So, yeah, nice to have him on the Calvos waves. And now we're gonna go. Across the pond once again. This is our sort of three out of four across the ponders, and I believe we have Lisa Whistlecroft with us. Do we have her with us?
We do indeed.
All right, there she is. And are you in Uxbridge?
I'm not in Uxbridge, but we have the Uxbridge Castanet Ensemble.
Oh, astounding.
Waiting for you. After yesterday's essay, we thought we should bring them onto your show.
That's so rewarding.
Well, bring them up. Bring them here. Let's hear them.
Oh, I do believe at least one member of your ensemble is suffering from Parkinson's disease. but in a good way.
That's just stage fright.
Ah.
The Uxbridge Castanet Ensemble. Well, thank you for that.
That's lovely.
So okay, now let's get serious.
What?
What?
What? I'm sorry. What have you been doing?
And why?
And why?
You mean, like...
Other than with your castanets.
Apart from with the castanets.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we should draw a veil over the castanets. Well, I don't know when we spoke last. It was about 2008, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had we were in our post-broadcast era. We had online-only shows for a while, and you were one of our guests then.
And it was amazing.
Yeah. But a fat lot of good it did us.
What, me being on your show?
Right.
Yeah, it closed down right after, didn't it?
It did. Exactly. That's what happened. We were gone. And it's all your fault.
We thought, sure, you would be bringing us fame and... I know fortune is a bit much of a stretch, but fame anyway.
Or at least advanced degrees. You've been doing sort of advanced degree things, haven't you?
I was just about to submit for an MPhil in composition at the point when we spoke, yes.
Yes.
And I submitted, and they gave me one. I think they gave me one to make me go away, because I'd been about 8 years doing a one-year degree, so I think they decided if they gave me the thing, then maybe I would get out of their hair. So, yeah, I got that.
And the topic was what?
It was all compositional stuff. I just had to keep making more music and handing it in, and that was it. Well, no, I wrote about it as well. But,
that's all we get from Lisa. No, it was compositional stuff. You know, I want to forget it. It was that long ago. Thank you. Don't ask me about my degree. I'm done with that.
Something like that, yeah.
Now, you've been doing some things, actually, in sound recording and in Iceland.
Yes. Going back to your original question, what have I been doing since? I've been doing two things. About the last thing I did before I got my degree was a dance piece with a wonderful choreographer that I knew. And as a result of that, I was approached by Louise Ann Wilson, who is an amazing environmental installation performance art maker. And she asked me to do some recordings for her for a piece, which I did. And I did a whole load of other recordings for that project, which she didn't in the end use, and I made a soundscape from it. And much to my amazement, it got shortlisted for a European soundscape competition. So I thought, oh, this is wonderful. So I got interested in environmental recordings, and then I got the most amazing opportunity to go to Iceland on a one-week sound recording course with Jez Riley French, who...
Yes.
Do you know Jez?
Not personally, but yes, I know
wonderful, wonderful, long, large-scale recordings with hydrophones and contact mics. And the other tutor was Chris Watson, who, of course, is, you know, wildlife recording. Mr. Wildlife Recording.
Mr. Wildlife.
And... So, yes, went to Iceland and discovered that the tiny little handheld recorder I used to make my stuff with was just a teensy bit inadequate for making real recordings in real environments. So I went back again with some better recording kit. So I've been doing two things. One is working with Louise Ann Wilson, producing sound for installations in her pieces. And the other is trying to make environmental recordings that I can use in my way, because I'm not ever going to be a jazz or a Chris Watson, but I'm trying to put things together that I can do.
Now, for our listeners, explain a little bit more about what it means to do environmental recordings, what they might be used for, and what the problems of recording of that kind are that your equipment was inadequate to capture.
The biggest problem is moving air. I was going to say I have a problem with wind, but I guess you'd take that the wrong way.
I certainly would. Or the right. Well, never mind. Yes, please continue.
The big problem is that taking the kind of kit I had, which was really intended for indoor use, outside, you don't record the wind. You just get the awful sound of the wind beating against the microphone, and it renders everything completely unlistenable.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And you know, everybody knows this. I was just some kind of idiot who thought I could take my little handheld Edirol and my little in-ear microphones and go out the walls with them and get recordings. Because I'd managed to do it all the previous times I'd needed to. You know, it was one of those things. Nobody had told me I couldn't, so I thought I could. And it wasn't until I got into really wild environments and where I was trying to get something authentic. I'd always known that I could process my sounds to make the thing I wanted to make, so it didn't matter if they didn't sound completely natural.
When you say really wild environments, are you talking about, say, the Eurovision Song Contest?
Oh, dear.
Who brought him?
We can send him back. We can send him back to the castanet room.
Yes, please do.
I thought it was a perfectly legitimate question.
No. Just outdoors in the open. Pretty well anywhere in Iceland is very windy. So when I went back the second time, I had invested in, you know, one of those sort of dead cats on a stick.
Yes, dead cats on a stick. I was hoping you were going to say that's what you were using, the dead cat, yeah. which actually looks like a dead cat, which is a wind blocker, and a very effective one, in fact, but it does look like a cat on a stick.
Very expensive, much more than a cat. It would have been easier to skin a cat. So yes, going back to what I've been doing, really two things: making immersive, slightly abstract sound environments for Louise-Anne Wilson, and then trying to make something out of my recordings in Iceland that isn't just a field recording. Not just a field recording in the sense of talking down about field recordings, but I can't do that well enough to publish anything, so I'm trying to make something that's more my kind of slightly abstract, slightly storytelling-y sort of thing. There's too many sort ofs in that sentence.
Just the right number.
They could be sort of
just
out.
The right number.
Sort of just the right number.
Oh, you sent us something to listen to.
I have. You might not like it.
Well, I hope we'll like it. Tell us a little bit about it.
Does it have anything to do with the Eurovision Song Contest?
Nothing whatsoever.
Oh, well, we'll listen anyway.
It just, see, the thing is, it just says, the file just says Dennis 22 August 15, and so that was mysterious to me. I was wondering that what it might could possibly have meant.
It's because I forgot which day I was on, and I thought it would be really useful if I called it the date that you were going to play it, and then after I'd sent it, I remembered I was on today, which isn't the 22nd.
So, does this use your environmental recordings?
Yes, it. All of the sounds in it were recorded in Iceland. Some are outdoor sounds. Having discovered that I could actually take my equipment out into windy weather and record the wind instead of just sounding like somebody was beating me around the head, there is some windy weather in it. There are some very quiet, it is a very quiet piece most of the time, there's some very quiet lakeside environments. I spent 2 hours at midnight. That's a very strange sound.
We're adding our own wind here.
You have a whoopee cushion in the studio.
Yes, we could actually add the thunder too.
So some of it was recorded by the side of a lake at midnight, It never got dark because I was there in June, and it was just very quiet, lapping of the water and distant bird calls. And then some of the more abstract droning sounds were made with contact mics on long wires. You don't get to go on a course with Jez Riley without making long wire recordings. and then there is some spoken material, which was very, very kindly spoken for me by the lady who ran the accommodation that I was staying in. She had noticed, she had information boards up with local folk tales, and she very kindly read some of them out to me.
Lisa Whistlecroft, really happy to talk with you again. I wish we had more time to do it, and I hope that one of these days, not too long from now, we'll be able to get over there and actually sit down and have some tea with you.
That would be nice. And I just, before I go, I just want to say congratulations on not only on surviving 20 years of Calvert and Damien, but this weekend's been absolutely fabulous. I listened to all of yesterday afternoon's broadcast, and it's been wonderful. So just many congratulations on a fabulous show.
Thanks so much. And now we're going to listen to this piece made from environmental recordings. Lisa Whistlecroft.